prophecy, this glimpse into future history, and not too distant in our future, as all of this will play out between now and at the very latest 2029, 2030. So in 2014, we are 15 or 16 years away from the culmination of all of these events. And since the destruction of Damascus is listed first, we should expect that that will occur within the next decade, that the fall of Syria as a nation would occur shortly thereafter, and that this is going to occur as we're witnessing it through the onslaught of terrorists, and that much of the carnage will take place because the people on both sides of this proxy war are repulsive. God described the fervor of religious fanaticism, particularly Islamic jihadism, and that it ultimately is going to ravage this region. But he also, in the next statement, is going to speak about the dissection of Israel, of Israel being forced to give up its West Bank, since it's already given up Gaza, recognizing that this is going to occur in stages based upon what God is about to tell us. It is reasonable to assume that the final act of the sacrifice of the West Bank, which the West Bank goes within 5 miles of the Mediterranean Sea, right around Tel Aviv, just north of Jerusalem, where 70% of Israelis live, that this treaty could well be in concert with, coincide with, the treaty that is announced in Daniel, which utters in the seven-year tribulation. If so, then the next statement that God is revealing is going to occur around November of 2026, and that this war will rage on between now and then, over the next 12 years. Also, to enhance our understanding of what Yahweh was foretelling by specifically delineating Ephraim, which he did in the previous statement, which represents the northern kingdom, in a prophecy which affirms that Israel is going to continue to exist, Yahweh is addressing the fate of 11 of the 12 tribes. While Benjamin was originally aligned with Yehudah, by making a distinction between the two names, Yahweh is saying that the destruction of Damascus and greater Syria will spare much of the nation, but leave Yehudah and thus Jerusalem vulnerable. I suspect this is because America, to placate the Muslim marauders, will compel the nation to surrender Samaria, known as the West Bank, to the Islamic terrorists. Affirming this, Yahweh, through his prophet named Yashayah, which means salvation is from Yah, revealed the following. And it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. And the fattest, best protected, and most important place of his body shall be leaned. This is Yashayah, Isaiah 17:4. Let's examine the words more closely and dissect as much information as we can from this statement. God says, and it will actually come to pass. This is Haya. It was written in the call perfect consecutive. So it's going to happen as a result of the choices made by men. This is going to be a travesty, but it's going to be a travesty of choice. And by using the call stem, we know this is literally going to occur. By using the perfect conjugation, that this is going to happen as a one-time event, in the sense of it's going to be complete. So it shall actually come to pass in that day. By writing Bahayom, God is saying that the surrender of much of Israel, leaning the nation at the waist, is going to occur at the same time that Syria is destroyed, ceasing to be a nation. At the same time that the terrorists have no one left to terrorize in Syria. At the same time that Damascus falls and becomes a twisted heap of rubble. That these events are related. That one leads to the other. That they occur in quick succession. That tells us that this is a more vital replaying of what happened when Neville Chamberlain ceded the high ground of Czechoslovakia to the Nazis, leading to World War II, just as God says this will lead to World War III. Now, he says that the size, hahu kabud, that the magnitude, that the dimensions, that the volume of Yaqub shall be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. Now, why do you think that God used Yaqub here as opposed to Yisrael? In today, when we think of Yisrael, we think of the nation that is on the maps, drawn with various borders of what a number of people claim is occupied and legitimately theirs. And it has now carved off, and it has much of the West Bank carved off. Well, God couldn't use Israel because there's far too many misconceptions of what Israel even represents. You know, surrendering the West Bank from the international community would not be thinning Israel, because the international community, being universally anti-Semitic, thinks that that's the borders of Israel. So it's not a thinning from their perspective. Now, Yaqub represents Israel. That's true. Yahweh renamed Yaqub Yisrael. So we know what God's talking about. And we're not talking about a man that at some point in the future is going to be thinned. Yaqub had passed away, you know, 1,000 years before Yeshayah is writing this. We're not talking about the fate of this individual being thinned at his waist so that he was no longer sustainable, that he may have had a beer belly and, oh boy, that was lean. No, we're not talking about the individual named Yaqub, but what Yaqub represents. And Yaqub, according to God, became Yisrael. There's a reason that he was renamed Yisrael. Now we know it. And so, by saying Yaqub, we know that it's not just Yisrael, as Israel is sometimes defined in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms as representing the northern kingdom, while Yehudah represented the southern kingdom that survived the initial Assyrian assault. That Yaqub would be all of Israel. The northern kingdom and Yehudah is being thinned. It is a statement that gives us a much better understanding of what God says is going to happen. The word da'al, which means shall be diminished, making the state incapable of surviving, being thinned and impoverished, so that normal life becomes impossible to support, is extraordinarily revealing. By making Israel 5 miles wide in proximity of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, the state will be unsustainable. It will be so vulnerable to attack by the Muslims who have pledged to destroy it that they will seek to do that very thing, and they will seek to do it instantaneously. God is making this absolutely clear, that the United States is lying when they say they want to have Israel with defensible borders, that the two peoples can live side by side in security. Every Israelite knows that that's not possible if the West Bank is surrendered to the Muslims after Gaza has now been surrendered to them. Every military strategist in the world knows that the country cannot live in security, that it is no longer sustainable, and God is putting us on notice, saying that he knows it as well. So we ought not believe our politicians when they speak of rhetoric of two nations, two peoples living side by side in security and peace. It isn't possible. And God has forewarned us of that very thing. The area that is being thinned is the fattest, best protected, and most important place, the mishmam, the waist, the midsection. The most stout and populated area is what mishmam represents. And if you look at where the line was drawn prior to 1967, when the accumulated and allied forces of the Islamic nations surrounding Israel were defeated and pushed back. When you look at where that line is, where the United States is trying to reestablish the 1967 borders, when you look at what that represents, you see that it comes right in at the waist, right at the midsection of Israel, right at the most populated, most important area of Israel, at the nation's midsection. God doesn't just get his predictions right. Every detail is precise. This is exactly what the United States is promoting. The body of Yisrael is going to be leaned, made thin, shrink in size. So Yahweh, by saying in that day, has affirmed what I assumed previously, that the divestiture of Israeli land is being tied to the fall of the Syrian regime. And as I predicted, while Bashar al-Assad is a ruthless dictator, the Sunni jihadists seeking to overthrow him are far worse. Not only for the Syrians and the conditions that the Syrians will endure when they prevail, but also for Israel. It is why it is so counterproductive for the United States to be arming and supporting the Sunni rebels. Also, by tying the Syrian war into the surrender of Israeli land, America becomes overtly culpable. The United States becomes guilty of starting, is not just becomes, is already guilty, really, of starting this proxy war through its invasion of Iraq, whereby the nation was given to Iran. But equally deserving of blame, it's the United States' military's awakening program that supplied the weapons that began this proxy war. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the break. We should also be cognizant that America is culpable in this upcoming and continual calamity. Not only because America invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to Iran, thereby empowering the Shia regime in Iran so that they came to not only to control Iraq, but also Syria and Lebanon, and therefore destabilized the region, causing the Sunni regimes like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates to lash out and provide mujahideen and weapons to Sunni jihadists to try to diminish the increase in military and political power and territory gained by the Iranians as a direct result of the counterproductive American invasion of Iraq. But that the United States provided the weapons that were initially used to turn this into a war as opposed to a political protest. It was the awakening program of Petraeus and the U.S. military under the Bush regime that was the means to weaponize this conflict. But also we should keep in mind that it's American weapons now that are being supplied through Qatar and through Saudi Arabia to the jihadists, which are making this conflict so deadly. It's those very weapons that are going to be turned on Israel. But keep in mind also that it's the United States that is supplying the Islamic world with 25 times more weaponry than it is to Israel, making Israel incapable of defending itself going forward. But also, at the same time, It's America, under the Obama regime, that has capitulated on the Iranian nuclear program, assuring that the threat of an atomic bomb could influence world opinion. You know, once it's known that the Iranians have gone beyond wanting an atomic bomb and of refining the uranium-235 to a sufficient quantity of it so that they have the ingredients for a bomb, and that they have developed the missile technology to deliver the bomb wherever they wish to deliver it. It's only a matter of time before the Iranians say, you either capitulate on what we want, which is Israel, or we're going to send off this nuclear bomb. And the United States is the lead agent in that capitulation. So Israel territory is going to be promoted primarily by the United States as a means of appeasing Team Islam, whether it be the Iranians in a nuke or the Islamic jihadists who are going to return from the great jihad in Syria to perpetrate all manner of terrorist attacks throughout the world as they did following the great jihad in Afghanistan, with the terrorist attacks throughout Europe, Russia, Africa, and the United States, a direct result. It's going to happen all over again. And the way to appease them is going to be seen as surrendering Israel, making it vulnerable, putting it up on a dish for Muslims to devour. Now, before we move on, I'd like to take a step back in time to gain a better perspective on the scope of this prophecy. For the events depicted here to occur as they were predicted 2,750 years ago, an already thrice conquered Israel would have to become reestablished and then made whole. After 1,900 years of exile following the sixth successful conquest of the Promised Land, that of the Romans in 133 CE, while the same Romans, then the Byzantines, followed sequentially by Shiite and then Sunni Muslims, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and then the British lorded over Israel, against all odds, the Israelites would have to return home and become a sovereign nation again and then reclaim the land that was once theirs. Now, this incomparable miracle occurred in stages over a long period of time. First, in 1948, the United Nations, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, where most Jews were killed, awarded a portion of the Promised Land to the surviving Israelites. Second, in that same year, facing nations that were established in the aftermath of World War I, which outnumbered them 1,000 to 1, each of which wielded vastly superior weapons, God's chosen people, fighting as civilians without so much as a common language, astonishingly won their war of independence against the combined forces of the Muslim world. We'll consider what happened next when we return after the commercial break. So even after the nation of Israel was reformed in the wake of the Holocaust, after 1,900 years of not existing. You know, the Romans brought in 3 legions. They devastated the place. They salted the land. They razed the what was left of the cities. They exported the population as slaves into Europe. And, you know, that was after, of course, the Assyrians hauled away the northern kingdom, 10 of the 12 tribes, into slavery in Mesopotamia. Many of them killed along the way. You know, there wasn't much left. And then after the onslaughts of, following that, of the Byzantines and the Islamic barbarians, that the nation is reestablished. But it's not reestablished whole. It's not Jacob. It's not in a position to be thinned. It's already thinned. And so, in their war of independence, battling odds of 1,000 to 1, they prevailed. And then, But even then, it still was not a nation that could be thin because it still remained thin. It was at least established and it existed. It wasn't swept into the sea. You know, Gaza and the West Bank belonged respectively to Egypt and Jordan. So it wasn't until the fledgling nation prevailed against a second unified Islamic assault in 1967 during the Six Days War that Israel reclaimed much of Yahweh's original gift. And even then, it would be another 44 years before America's invasion of Iraq would lead to the Syrian war, ultimately linking the destruction of Damascus with the sacrificing of Israeli land for promises of peace. It's an extraordinary amount of things that had to occur that were unimaginable prior to just this past decade. What makes this prophecy extraordinary is when it is committed to writing millennia ago in the waning days of the 8th century BCE, somewhere between 740 and 730 BCE, Israel was being ripped to shreds. Its cities were being razed and its people were being enslaved. This wasn't even imaginable that this could occur. Moreover, we possess ancient verifications of these predictions. The great Isaiah scroll, for example, dates to 200 BCE. And it's the oldest surviving complete copy of any book written in antiquity. And just the miracle of that alone boggles the mind. The fact is, conditions that would have been completely inconceivable at the time they were being foretold are just now materializing before our very eyes. Ephraim, representing the northern kingdom, at the time of this writing was separated from Yehuda, which means that a unified Yisrael couldn't be thinned at the waist. The northern kingdom itself was under siege, being attacked by the world's most ruthless superpower, Assyria. Huge swaths of the nation were falling under the control of Assyrian monarchs, Tiglath-Pileser III and Salmaneser V. The latter son, Sargon II, and his successor, Sennacherib, following in his father's footsteps, took 20 years to systematically ransack most of what King David, Dode, and his son Solomon had built over 200 years previously. Now, by way of background, so that we know just how improbable this prediction was, after the death of Solomon, which is Shlomo in Hebrew, in 931 BCE, every tribe except Yehuda and Benjamin refused to accept Rehoboam's, the son and successor of Solomon, as their king. Now, the rift occurred for reasons that we see play out today, because he refused to lower what was a rather onerous tax imposed by his licentious father. So these 10 tribes preferred Jeroboam. Jeroboam, as he's called in Bible transliterations, who was residing in all places Egypt at the time. So upon his return in 920 BCE, they pronounced him king in Shechem, leaving Yehuda completely isolated and Yisrael totally divided. It was now the kingdom of Yehuda versus the northern kingdom, which retained the name Yisrael and it was often referred to as Ephraim. These choices set the stage for the dramatic events transpiring as Yahshiyah transcribed Yahweh's haunting predictions. By 740 BCE, the Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser, began to systematically brutalize and enslave the remnants of Israel, causing 10 of Jacob's 12 tribes to be considered lost. Reuben and Gad were the first to succumb, then Manasseh. They were taken to Assyria, fish hooks placed in their noses, ropes between them, where they would remain for centuries. In fact, for millennia. Then in 722 BCE, the surviving capitals of the northern kingdom were ransacked, both Shechem and Tirzah, along with most of Samaria under King Omri. During this siege, Salmaneser V died and was succeeded by Sargon II. Of his conquest, he wrote, "Samaria I looked at. I captured 27,280 men who dwelt in it. I carried away to Assyria," end quote. It's duly recorded in an ancient steel by the victors. And this appeared to be the final curtain for the kingdom of Yisrael. It had been wiped off the face of the earth, its inhabitants taken away. The oldest extant collaborations of this period, besides the testimony found in Chronicles and Kings, include the aforementioned Assyrian steel inscription discovered in ancient Syria, in addition to an intriguing steel found in Moab, which is today Jordan. It's called the Mishah steel. It's a 3-foot-tall, smooth block of basalt stone, which contains the longest Iron Age inscription ever found. It was written in the Moabite language in the 9th century BCE, but using the Hebrew alphabet. The history depicted in the inscription parallels the account initially reported in the Book of Kings. It refers to the kingdom of Yisrael as distinct from the kingdom of Yehuda. It delineates the house of Omri, the king, as well as the house of Dod, David. It even refers to Yahweh by name. This, of course, these inscriptions are devastating to the Muslims who claim that they have a history in this place. But these collaborations are important because they affirm that Yahweh's eyewitness portrayal of human events, whether past, present, or future, are always accurate. His portrayal of what occurred is precisely what we find occurred. It is what the histories of the nations opposing Israel have written as well. From God's perspective, the reason that the past, present, and future predictions and portrayals are all accurate is that God sees the past, the present, and future all at one time. It's important to know that his past accounting of events is always accurate, just as his future accounting of events, because they come to us exactly the same way. God has witnessed the horrible choices we have made and has reported to us in our past what he has witnessed in our future. He has seen it. He's not predicting it. He's reporting it. God has seen the whole human experience and has provided an eyewitness testimony of exactly what has and will occur. And he's done so for a number of reasons. The primary reason that God has provided us with this is that he doesn't want us to be surprised. He doesn't want us to be bewildered. He doesn't want us to think, for example, that he made a promise to Abraham which is not going to be completed, not going to be honored because Israel is gone. And he would look at it and say, wait a minute, he promised this covenant and this land to the descendants of Abraham, of Yishak, and Jacob, and yet the Israelites have been dispersed. The land has been destroyed. Well, if God tells us what's going to happen, and it does happen, then we have reason to have ever confidence that no, God's going to honor that promise. And here's how. In spite of all of man's endeavors to keep it from being honored, God's going to intervene and honor it. That's one of the reasons he tells us this. Another reason is that so we might understand the consequence of our own actions. so that we might know that when we come to know Yahweh, when we trust and rely on who He is and what He is offering, when we engage and embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant, we are protected. We benefit. But when we reject these terms, as the Israelites did, when we dishonor them, when we reject them, then we're savaged by all manner of human malfeasance. There's a consequence of our actions, both favorable and unfavorable. God wants us to know that as a loving Father. But also, these predictions exist so that we might have a means of knowing for certain that the author of the Torah and prophets can be trusted. When we find that He got every detail of history right, the only universally reliable portrait of human history, and that He got every aspect of future history right, every prophecy precisely right, right down to the fact that Israel's midsection is going to be thinned, making the nation unsustainable, and the direct aftermath of a terrorist assault against Damascus causing Syria to fall, that these kind of precise predictions and that the leaning of Israel is a direct result of that tells us that this cannot be by random chance. That a spirit, that an individual that lives outside of the constructs of time revealed this to us. Turning here to the historical narrative to understand how improbable this prediction was and the realization that since there is no chance that this prophecy was just randomly produced and just happened to come true before our eyes, and therefore we ought to recognize that it was inspired by a being who was not constrained by time, who had seen our future. We recognize that the kingdom of Judah survived the initial Assyrian assault partly because the small nation capitulated and became a vassal state. But some 20 years later, one of the most remarkable stories in the whole of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is the story of Hezekiah, of Chikiah, as the king of Judah, sought to end the nation's subservience to its Mesopotamian overlords. He ceased paying the tribute tax that was imposed by Assyria, and he forged, unfortunately, an alliance with Egypt. But the Egyptians proved unreliable in the fourth year of Sennacherib's reign. Jerusalem, particularly Udim, were isolated and defenseless. And as a result, there were 185,000 Assyrian soldiers who were coming to take the tribute that they thought that Yehudah ought to have been paying them. But they weren't going to take it in the sense of, oh yeah, could you just please remit the last payment to us? No, they were going to take everything, including the Israelites, the Yehudim, as slaves. And they would destroy everything in their wake to teach any nation a lesson that refused to pay them tribute. Well, there were 185,000 of the best armed, most powerful, best disciplined, most disciplined soldiers in the world that were bearing down on this tiny little town, now no more than just a city-state of Jerusalem, with the intent of taking what was little was left of what of the whole kingdom that Dode, King David, had forged. But as it would transpire, what happened next serves as the ultimate lesson for us today. Hopelessly outnumbered, Hezekiah initially tried to pay off Sisenareb with 300 talents of silver and 30 of gold. But after the payment was made, the Assyrian king, rather than retreating, renewed his assault and laid siege to Jerusalem. So after his faith in military alliances, his faith in money, his faith in potentates proved unreliable, the king tried the opposite approach and came to rely upon the Torah and its author, Yahweh. He read the Torah, which was found in some recess of the temple, and he read it for the first time probably in hundreds of years. And he says, oh, boy, have we ever made some horrible choices. So the first thing he did is he had every vestige of religion removed from Yehuda. And he worked to prepare his people so that they could celebrate Passover on yeasted bread and firstborn children in accordance with Yahweh's Torah instructions. And until they separated themselves from religion, until they separated themselves from this patriotic view of the country, from politics, from military support, until they separated themselves from these things, they weren't prepared to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Makorim. And he knew it by reading the Torah. And so he prepared them. And he prepared the country, removing all vestiges of religion from the people's midst. This approach, their collective trust, their willingness to observe the Torah and act upon its guidance was sufficient. Yahweh did the rest, sending out just one of his malach messengers to poison the Assyrian army as they prepared for the final assault outside the city gates. As it turns out, all he did is cause the water that flowed outside of the city to be laced with a poison. They drank it. They died. It was a victory without firing a shot. God protected his people from those who wished to destroy them. Glenn, I know you're still listening in with us. I suppose that would be a lesson for today, that we could do better than spend hundreds of billions of dollars on our military.
Music playing, so I'll wait.
Well, we're actually to the end of our show today.
Oh,
I apologize for asking.
That's fine. Well, certainly the Israelites have been regathered are no choir boys, pun intended, but when they are truly facing an existential threat, it's my hope they'll repent and receive much better results.
And rely on Yahweh, and indeed they will.